Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, in Nigeria, the government is offering free emergency caesarean sections for women who can't afford them. But will this stop the high rate of maternal deaths? Mabel Onwumele speaks from experience.
I would say I am happy with the initiative, but you know that if it is handled by competent professionals, it will be a welcome development. Because while I was in the hospital, I saw the death of a new mom that had twins and died. And this is a young lady that was sharing a lot of her ambitions, but all of a sudden her life was cut short.
And I want you to meet Dr. Abdon Atangana. He is the world's top-rated mathematician. And he says we can all be mathematicians just like him.
I don't have two heads. I'm a simple man like everyone. Because everybody is doing mathematics every day. We were born with mathematics. How do we make sure that you cross the road and the car does not hit you? It is mathematics that you're using. You do mathematics every day in your life. Everybody is a mathematician.
It's Tuesday, the 12th of November. First, we go to Somaliland. Presidential elections are expected to happen in Somaliland this Wednesday after a two-year delay. The country is a bit of an anomaly in the Horn of Africa. It is peaceful in a rough neighborhood, continent-wide as well, because it has peaceful elections, mostly. But let's hear how and why Somaliland came about and why it is the way it is. Here's Nyasha Michelle.
Somaliland is located on the southern shore of the Gulf of Aden in eastern Africa. Its population is estimated to be over 6 million. Somaliland is originally a British protectorate. It gained independence in 1960 and united with Somalia. But after a devastating civil war, Somaliland declared independence from Somalia in 1991. And although it has functioned as a self-governing state for over three decades, it still lacks formal recognition from the international community. In contrast to much of the Horn of Africa, Somaliland has built a relatively peaceful and democratic society, showing that democracy can flourish even with limited resources. The people of Somaliland are ethnically Somali, and their society is structured around clan affiliations, which play a significant role in politics and social life. The Isaac clan is in the majority in Somaliland, with the Samaroon clan in the west and the Hati clan in the east also holding influence. This clan-based social system, known as clan democracy, shapes government and decision-making across the region. Relations with Somalia remain tense, and tensions have worsened in recent years. In early 2024, Somaliland signed an agreement with Ethiopia, allowing the landlocked country access to Somaliland's ports, marking a strategic economic development for both nations. Somaliland also maintains a close relationship with Taiwan, a significant development partner which has led to strained relations with China. Meanwhile, the United Arab Emirates is Somaliland's largest investor, bringing in substantial foreign investment.
The upcoming elections were due to be held back in 2022, but the incumbent, President Musse Bihi Abdi, postponed them, saying there were scheduling and financial issues. Opposition parties accused him of wanting to stay in power beyond his mandate. It's a familiar ploy, and it's a familiar accusation. We've heard it all before. Anyway, negotiations between the incumbent and the opposition led to an agreement, and now we are on the eve of the elections. Mohamed Farah Hersi and I picked up the discussion. He is the director of the Academy for Peace and Development in Somaliland. You may have noticed that we can't talk about Somaliland without talking about Somalia. Our conversation included other ways in which Somaliland is different to Somalia, the country it broke away from. For instance, the clan system dominates politics, making direct elections difficult in Somalia. Somalia has selections rather than elections. But first, was it unusual to delay the elections in 2022? Because delayed elections often are a signal that democracy is not necessarily very high on the agenda of the incumbent. So I'm just wondering what it meant in Somaliland, because Somaliland has a reputation for democracy and good practice.
This was not the first time to delay the presidential elections. It happened in the past in 2010 and 2003 as well. But it is a combination of political factors as well as, you know, economic factors. You know, most of the elections in Somaliland is funded by either donors and from the international community and the government. And sometimes there are technical problems with all those obstacles and challenges. You know, most of these elections are not held on time. And in accordance with our constitution, when the elections are delayed or postponed, then the House of Elders, which is the highest lawmaker in Somaliland, and then extends the power of the incumbent president and the vice president. So it is not unusual.
But was it ominous?
Yes.
Tell us why.
Because, you know, in 2017, the last presidential elections, you know, after the elections, you know, it has created political divisions within Somalian society. And opposition parties, you know, who lost in 2017 elections did not accept those elections back then. And the government also did not come up with a kind of a unifying strategy where different clans and different interest groups are harmonizing in a way which creates a more social cohesion of Somalian people. So considering political landscape of Somaliland and considering the internal definitions of Somaliland political elites, it was a quite challenging for the people and for the economy and for the region as well.
So we often make a big deal of the fact that Somaliland is, you know, an island of safety, security and stability, considering the neighborhood that it's in. And that elections, generally, there's no violence in the country and so on. But another thing that differentiates it, I think, is it also elects people directly to government and to the houses of lawmakers and the president. Is that the case? Because in Somalia, it's more of a selection rather than an election.
Perfectly, that is the case. You know, the first time in Somaliland organized cities, democratic elections was 2002. So since 2002 until 2024, you know, Somaliland has held more than 9 elections in a very peaceful manner. So this is unusual. It's unprecedented. It's unparalleled, considering with this tough neighborhood in the region, and where democratic elections are not respected, where one-party system becomes the norm of the political culture of these countries, which are neighbor to Somaliland. And so, you know, what's happening here in Somaliland at the moment, it's something that Somaliland has been doing for the last 25 years, but it is something which is also not being promoted or respected by the international community by actually giving Somaliland what it deserves, which is international recognition.
Okay, let's deal with that very quickly. Why do you think Somaliland, in spite of the fact that it actually is an oasis in a very rough neighborhood, has been conducting itself with decorum and actual according to best practice, but yet has to win a single friend in the African Union, on the continent, or around the world?
You know, Somaliland has done itself unimaginable achievements, whether it's regard to state building, which has been successful, but at the same time, it contributes to the regional stability of the Horn. It combats against Al-Shabaab and international terrorists. And at the same time, it actually tries to prevent the radicalism in the Horn. But with all those achievements, including the democratic elections that has been taking place for the last 25 years, still the international community still focuses on what's happening in Somalia rather than what's happening in Somaliland.
So why do you think that's the case? Why is Somaliland and its achievements being ignored?
I think it's because it has been held hostage by the One Somalia policy, mostly adopted by the US and European countries. It is not rational, and that policy cannot be translated on what's happening on the ground.
I was asking you earlier if I was right in saying that Somaliland actually has direct elections,
yes,
rather than selections, which is the case in Somalia because of the clan system. So explain to us how the clan system does operate, if it does, in Somaliland in politics.
You know, the clan system is a social structure which has a historical significance, but it has a little thing to do about how elections are organized, how voters behave or vote, or how political parties interact with each other and how they compete for power. So it's a social structure which is still in place, which has an influence on how politics and power works here in Somaliland. But you have political parties, they present their political manifesto, they communicate and their supporters, and they actually convince national audiences and Somalian citizens to for them, for their agenda. And each party have their own political manifesto. They have their own agenda. And each party has a different ideological base.
So you're saying that people will vote across clan lines if they support the agenda of a party?
Yes. Much depends on the agenda of the party. If the party presents a very clear agenda, like what they are going to do about health, education, security, you know, foreign policy, all these things, and most of the people are convinced about that agenda, then they vote for that party. So clan system still plays a very important role, but it's not the main actor here in Somaliland politics.
So let's talk about the main candidates in this election and what they stand for and what people will be judging them on.
We have three main candidates. The same candidates we have had back in 2017. President Musa Bihi is now the current president of Somaliland. He has been in power for the last 7 years. He has a record of being a political as well as a veteran, and he fought the last regime back in the 1980s. And he has been one of the most political figures in Somaliland history. Then you have the main opposition party leader, Wadani, Abdulrahman Mohamed Abdullahi Ira. He was the Speaker of Parliament for 15 years in Somaliland, and then he became the opposition leader since 2012. And he lost 2017 elections, and since then he has been trying to win the popular vote. And then lastly, you have Faisal Ali Hussein, who is the leader of Uud Party, and he has been in that position for the last 20 plus years. And he's one of the longest serving chairman of the opposition parties. He contested three presidential elections, all of which he lost, and now he's standing for his fourth time. Their policies are quite different with regard to the foreign policy as well as the national security agenda of Somaliland. So they do have different perspectives. Yeah.
So let's talk about very quickly regional matters concerning Somaliland. The deal to provide a port for Ethiopia, much to Somalia's annoyance, and also Somaliland has been threatened by Somalia about that deal. So do all those running for president now support that deal, or is that an issue that the electorate will be looking at as well?
I think, you know, definitely the current president, who is the leading individual of the deal, I think if he's re-elected, President Bihi is re-elected in these elections, and he will make sure that the deal is sealed and it's implemented in a very mutual way, which benefits both sides. I think that the two other opposition parties, Uud and Wadani, they have not contested against the deal, but I think with Wadani, they might have a different, you know, perspective in terms of negotiations or in terms of the implementation of the deal. But I think across the board, these parties have shown their lack of commitment of implementing the deal after the election. So I think they will, but with Wadani in power, if they, you know, win these elections, they might resume talks with Somalia, as they have already mentioned in their political manifesto. And if they do that, then it's going to be very difficult for them to navigate and to make sure that the deal between Somalia and Ethiopia is actually sealed. And then the continuation of the talks between Hargeisa and Mogadishu is also continued. So if they can't actually pursue two different agendas at the same time, so either they have to go with the Ethiopian side or they can actually go with Somalia. On either side, they may have their problems and consequences.
How does the population feel about the deal? Because it does open up the possibility of Somalia attacking Somaliland.
I think, you know, with what's happening in Somalia, it is totally, absolutely unimaginably possible for Somalia to attack Somaliland. They don't have the military capability to do that now or in the coming 20 years. So I think that's out of the picture. But I think what they are...
But it does have strong friends in Egypt, for instance, that could help it.
What they can do is to have some sort of a proxy war against Somaliland, to create militias like the way they have done now in Las Anod, which is a region of Somaliland. They can do that. They can collaborate with other countries who are not comfortable with the deal, like Egypt, which they have already done that. So proxy war, highly possible, but an active hostility between Hargeisa and Mogadishu is quite impossible. So I think the deal will go ahead if President Buhari comes into power again.
I was asking if the population favors the deal, yes, or is it an election issue at all?
I think it was during the campaign trail. It was a big agenda. And most of the Somalian people, they support the deal. 87% of the people actually responded that they support the deal. So the deal is good for Somaliland in terms of its economic development and in terms of its diplomatic achievements. That's a huge achievement for Somaliland. And it creates a space where Somaliland can interact with other countries and get what it deserves, which is joining the international system to get international investment.
Are these elections more tense than elections have been in the past for Somaliland, given that it's happening 2 years later?
Yes, they do, because now, you know, in 2017 or before 2017, most of presidential elections were done in a way which is, you know, advantageous to Somaliland, meaning, you know, Somaliland was isolated from the rest of the world, and Somaliland had little to do about what was happening in the region. But now, with the MOU signed with Ethiopia and with other regional actors and players who are not comfortable with the deal, I think that creates, you know, and imposes a threat to the national security of Somaliland. And one of these threats are radical extremists who are not happy with the deal as well, like Al-Shabaab. And I think there are possibilities and potential risks about the future of Somaliland security. And, you know, regional actors are actually involved in what's happening in Somaliland, like Djibouti or Somalia or other countries who doesn't want to see Somaliland progress it or get recognition from the international community. So it's very intense, and the stakes are very high, and much depends on the outcome of these elections.
Thank you so much. This has been really interesting.
Okay, thanks.
All right then. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Mohamed Farah Hersi, Director of the Academy for Peace and Development in Somaliland. Now to Nigeria, where women die in childbirth at an alarmingly high rate. More than 1,000 women die per 100,000 births. It's the fourth highest rate in the world. One of the reasons is the fact that too few women can get an emergency procedure called a caesarean section, where the mother is cut open and the infant taken out that way. It's a relatively expensive procedure, and it needs to be done by qualified, well-trained professionals with proper medical infrastructure to make it safe. To address this high rate of maternal mortality, the Nigerian Health Ministry has introduced a new program allowing poor and vulnerable pregnant women to get emergency caesarean sections for free. The goal is to try and reach those who can't afford these life-saving procedures and to expand health coverage for the country's poorest communities. We've been hearing the views of young Nigerian women.
So this is a really, really nice idea, and I just hope that it's executed very well, and whatever the process is to filter out the women who really need this care, I hope the process is fair and square and there's no corruption in the whole process.
You know, some Nigerians also have this sense of, oh, that's what they'll say, and then they'll just give it to their own people who will rig the system and all of that. So if it can be defined, does it mean women who are at the hospital and cannot afford to pay and have been there? So are we going to also backtrack and say, okay, you know, there's some women that have been in the hospital for maybe a week or 2 weeks. They've actually done the operation for them, but they're not able to release them because they didn't pay for that service. So it needs to be defined.
I picked up the discussion with Mabel Onwimele, who started the Women of Purpose Foundation to help rural women who need proper, safe medical attention during childbirth. She speaks from painful personal experience.
When I had my last baby, I was open up. I had the baby through CS. In fact, when it was time to have the baby, I was told the baby was breached, that I have to undergo surgery, which, you know, I accepted. After the surgery, I began to feel very uneasy. I was bleeding profusely, like they couldn't stop the bleeding. So after that, I just saw confusion everywhere in the hospital. And the next day, I was wheeled back to the theater. After the second surgery, the bleeding became more intense, and my tummy became like three times more than it was before the baby was removed. I was rushed from that hospital to an intensive unit of another hospital where the third surgery was done. All of this within 12 days.
That must have been terrifying. What was happening?
Very terrifying. Very terrifying. So at the end of it, after the third surgery, a doctor whispered to my husband in confidence that the first hospital forgot surgical scissors and gauze in my tummy. That was why I was uneasy. I was bleeding. I was gasping for breath. I took 27 pints of blood, antibiotics. And after those issues, I was in the hospital for almost 1 year. I lost the use of my legs for close to 2 years after I had this child.
I can't imagine that. When you said that they had left gloves and tools inside you, Myself and my colleagues here in the studio, you could hear our jaws drop and the horror in our eyes. You had a cesarean section. Is that when it happened? The first operation?
Yes. Yeah, the first one, yes. They brought out the baby, and that was where my pain and problem and trauma started. Even till today, because during the corona time, I was bedridden. Throughout the corona, I just had a relapse. All of a sudden, I just fell and I couldn't walk again. And the doctor said, I'm supposed to be on physiotherapy for a very, very long time. I shouldn't have stopped after I got okay. So the trauma that I had, I don't think it's better experience than explain. I can't explain it. But all of this was due to negligence or mistake or error on the part of the medical practitioners. So when you talk about women suffering because of someone's mistake, it's bizarre. It's not something that anyone should experience. So using my own story, I would say I am happy with the initiative that this is happening, but you know that if it is handled by competent professionals, competent medical practitioners, it will be a welcome development. Because while I was in the hospital, I saw the death of a new mom that had twins and died just after her surgery. She was bleeding profusely. And this is a young lady that was sharing a lot of her, you know, life ambitions with people around her. But all of a sudden, her life was cut short. What I'm saying in a nutshell is, it's a welcome development, but should be done by competent medical practitioners.
And how can you assure that?
It's to make sure these people are intentional. I think medical practitioners, not just, if you know you're a professional, people's lives are in your hands, you should at one point or the other be updating what you know, because it's totally unreasonable. Totally bizarre for someone to say, someone who went to school to read medicine and make that kind of mistake. That was, in fact, I was doing like a lab rat. Okay. So if competent practitioners handle this C-section, I don't think there will be a problem.
No, what I was asking is, how can the government reassure and assure Nigerian women and would-be parents that the practitioners of C-sections in the country will be competent? Are they going to be able to enforce competence on the doctors that will be performing these free cesarean sections on poor and vulnerable women? Because let's face it, you are not a poor and vulnerable woman, and yet your life was endangered and you are still suffering the effects now.
I can't really say much on that because I'm not the government and I'm not a medical practitioner.
But you'll be pushing for this, would you?
Yes, sure. I'm only advising and advocating that people who are in this position should be updated all the time, should make sure they are much more intentional, because most of these people are just all about the money. For you to see someone who is really passionate about, you know, their job, it's really bad. So I don't know how that will work to make sure that the doctors who are handling these things are licensed and they follow the regulatory bodies and are okay, are very competent in taking care of these pregnant women.
How is a C-section generally viewed in Nigeria? Because I know in some contexts people feel that, you know, it's a shortcut, as it were, to pushing and labor. And so it's stigmatized in that way. Is that the case in Nigeria in some places as well?
Sure, yeah, there is so much stigmatization in that area. If as a woman you tell people that you didn't have a vaginal birth, that you had a C-section, they feel like you're lazy.
Are these women saying that, or are these people who have not had babies and don't know what it entails?
Mostly women.
Even if it was a medical emergency?
Yes, most of these people feel that vagina, for you to show how strong you are as a woman, you should have vagina birth.
Right. So are we to take it then that the government will take into account the horror stories that some women have suffered, women like you, with emergency C-sections? And do you think that they will make sure that the practitioners are actually qualified and trained so that you don't have so many women dying in childbirth because of it?
I do hope so, because each day, almost 159 women die during childbirth. And all of this is as a result, most of this is as a result of negligence from the part of the medical practitioners. What I will advocate and advise for the government of Nigeria to do is to make sure more people are trained. Even if you're a doctor, there should be maybe every 3 months training to update on what you know. And there should also be accessibility to free ultrasound for these women who are underprivileged so they can access the free C-section.
Mabel Onwemele is the founder of the Women of Purpose Foundation in Nigeria. We had a response from the health ministry about Ms. Onwemele's experiences. The ministry questioned why she didn't report it to the medical council at the time. The statement said that it was unfair to question the competence of all physicians. It went on to state that the health ministry doesn't deal directly with individual health incidents anyway. A final point, the ministry said if the case was taken to the medical council and no action was taken then, a petition could have been sent to the minister for further investigation. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Now, if, like me, you can read and write quite well, but you really can't count, then this next conversation is for you. Let's talk about maths, or math, as the Americans say. But we're not Americans, so we'll say maths, or mathematics, because we are talking to the top-rated mathematician in the world. His name is Dr. Abdon Atangana from Cameroon. He's the academic head of a department and professor of applied mathematics at the University of the Free State in South Africa. You may not know this, but his work has transformed the world of applied mathematics by finding solutions to real-world issues like groundwater movement, infectious disease control modeling, remember COVID, and the rate of decay between meat and bone matter. Yeah, I did not know that we needed a mathematical equation for that. What I also didn't know is that we are all mathematicians. From walking across the road to braiding our hair, we apply maths to help us navigate the world. What's more, Dr. Atangana reminded me that maths began on our continent. He's been rewarded for his work, not just by being ranked the number one mathematician in the world, but also as a beacon of black excellence. I was able to talk to him shortly after he'd picked up the Black Star Awards in New York. Well, you're very welcome on Focus on Africa. Thank you so much for speaking to us. And congratulations on your latest award. You have been gathering awards and accolades for your entire career almost. Tell us about the latest one that you've just come from in the US.
This one, they invited me, telling me that due to my contribution in mathematics, especially the fact that I was ranked number one last year in applied mathematics, so they recognize all the black star around United States that I was choosing out of the United States. So we went there, I saw many CEOs, they came from all over. I even see the mayor of one city from Ireland. We saw people from NASA, people from Amazon, people from Genentech, and they selected, I think, few people that they gave that award.
Right. So tell us about being ranked number one, because I imagine that the competition is very, very fierce. What is the ranking based on and who makes the ranking?
The ranking is made by some people from the University of Stanford. What is your contribution? What have you contributed in mathematics that people are citing, people are using, people are writing thesis based on your work, and how many people are in your paper that you write? For example, some people can be 20 of them in one paper. And the question is, what is your contribution? If you are 20 of you, who is the person who contributed the most? So they take into account the number of authors in the paper, the influence of the paper in the field compared to other paper, the number of citation, and the impact also to see how many people are using the work that you have produced.
Okay, so how many people are on that list?
Many, many, many people, close to 80,000 or 90,000 or 100,000, yes.
So out of 80 to 100,000 people, you came out tops?
Yes, I came out top in applied mathematics.
So how can you, as a teacher of maths and one of the number one ranked mathematician, interest people in mathematics? Because I believe that the teaching of mathematics and the interest in mathematics is at a low on the continent especially.
Yes, you are right. There are several reasons. The first reason is the way they teach mathematics to the younger one. You try to explain to the kid not only the formula, but where that formula will be applied. And you try to explain to the kid that for you to become a good chemist tomorrow, you need to know this particular formula that I'm presenting to you, because it's going to be used here in chemistry, it's going to be used here in geography. So you show the importance of the mathematical formula that you are showing to kid. Most of the time when we went to school, it was only theory, it was only formula. And sometimes even the teacher doesn't know exactly where this thing are applied. And another thing is, when we grow up, they told us that when you do mathematics, you end up as a teacher. But they don't tell us that when you are doing mathematics, you can work in several places. You can work in the bank, you can be a pilot, you can work in many companies, for example, Mercedes, you can work in telecommunication, you can work almost everywhere. You know, nature was created by God. We agree. And God asks us to understand nature so that we should be in control of that nature. For you to understand nature, there are a few steps that you have to follow. The first step is you observe a specific real-world problem that you want to understand in nature. When you observe it, then you collect data. After the collection of data, you analyze it, then you can transform or you can translate the observation into a mathematical model. When you do it, then you solve your model, you compare it with your data. If there is a good agreement, then you can do prediction. So mathematics was created by human beings to understand the nature, so that they can predict what will happen in the future and control the environment.
So for somebody listening now, they're thinking, that sounds interesting, but I don't think I can do it. Can anybody do maths, and can anybody be good at maths?
I don't have two heads. I'm a simple man like everyone. And you know, to be a good mathematician, there is a discipline that is needed. You have to work only hard, because everybody is doing mathematics every day. We were born with mathematics. How do we make sure that the car... you cross the road and the car does not hit you. It is mathematics that you're using. You do mathematics every day in your life. Everybody is a mathematician, but it depends on the level.
So because you're a mathematician and because you're a number one ranked mathematician, you would say that everybody should do maths, everybody should study maths, would you?
Of course. As I told you, it is a tool that human being created to understand nature. So if you want to understand nature properly, you must have some basic in mathematics.
Okay. Let's go to the history of maths on the continent. Tell us about mathematics in Africa.
Let me tell you, I like this part, because most of the time they make us think that mathematics was created only by the West. No, it is wrong. There are several mathematical formulas that were created here in Africa. You know, just take a simple example, the way we design our clothes. You will see there are some features that are known in mathematics as fractal. And this is a very deep subject in mathematics that it has application in all the fields. And that fractal was created here in Africa. For example, our lady, the way they plait their hair, it is mathematics. So you will notice that several important mathematicians came in Africa, like Thales, Pythagoras. They came in Egypt to have a conversation. And it is not documented why they came and with whom they were working, you know. They only tell us that they were here, but they don't tell us, this guy came in Egypt, they work with who and what is the discussion that they had, and they did not document it. So mathematics, of course, was here before the European people arrived, and they came here also to learn mathematics. But in terms of some mathematical formula like derivative, it was introduced by people from the West. So Africa is the land of mathematics. The only thing is that it was not documented. That is why I plead every day with African Union to build what we call a publishing house, such that Africa should have its own publishing house, that all the knowledge that we produce should be published by African people.
That was Dr. Abdon Atangana from Cameroon, the world's top-ranked mathematician. Focus on Africa was carefully stitched together by Sunita Nahar, Nyasha Michelle and Victor Silva here in London. Blessing Aderogba added her bit from Lagos. Kani Sharp was the senior journalist in charge of quality. Our technical producer, Jonathan Greer, made sure we made it on air and online in time. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. And a quick reminder, we have a YouTube channel. Do subscribe. I'm Audrey Brown. We'll talk again next time.